one. Secondly, on the issue of KFQ, I don't know what, if you actually said what's going to be the projected under expenditure, for example, on KFQ, 2010, this financial year. But do you know roughly the... But let's do this. Let's by the end of today, because we know it's not, hopefully there is no under expenditure, but there can be a projected under expenditure based on the reality now. Because if we're in the last quarter, is it? Essentially, December is here. Let's get a magical figure for this projected under expenditure. And let's say, between the committee, because we just came back from Limpopo, Giyani, it's a important region and province in the context of the State of the Nation address. If that is a rural province, and you've got the, hopefully into the future, the potential of, and one of our members are punting this thing very sharply, of Mpumalanga and Northern Cape, which is rural provinces, is there a potential to make sure that over the next month that we actually sharpen our space around the possibility of that projected under expenditure and the kind of intervention on scarce skills, in a sense fishing for people in those two or three provinces. Now, we've requested that in August. It's not forthcoming, so my suggestion is that we're actually going to then make that a second item on the agenda with the minister. So we will convene a meeting formally with the minister on this act. But so that we then help draft a strategy, if needs be, on it. The reason why I was tongue-in-cheek asking about acting, the reality is whatever, you've analyzed some of the weaknesses, you've analyzed some of the interventions to be done, but most probably soon, whoever that person is, whether it's yourself or not yourself, whoever that person is, there's most probably another review taking place. Because every new person come and want to make an analysis, want to reflect on certain things. So I'm saying, whilst all of that happens, there's a new board chairperson, stempel moet afgedruk raak, must new kid on the block. So all of that brings, where I'm sitting, a little bit of instability in the process. Now, instability is not necessarily bad, but if you need also to keep the kite flying and fix the plane whilst you are flying, it is a matter of how do you bring these two together. And what I'm not finding, it's somehow that subtext strategy. So whilst we are doing all these grand things, and hopefully we're getting it all right, there is a below-the-belt strategy that needs to ensure that we give a little bit of relief over the next 2 years. Member Makubela raised the questions around administration and all of those things. I think the audit report is quite clear. There's serious concerns relating to performance processes. And monitoring and all of that, and we hope that NSFAS will be able to deal with that. But on the whole, we can see that a lot of our young people, a lot of our students are benefiting precisely from the work done by NSFAS. Yes, there's clearly weaknesses, there's concerns, there's constraints, there's problems, but in the existing legal envelope, that it's clear to us that the majority of the students that we can help, we're helping. I think there is other elements that's most probably not your responsibility that we're going to have to look at in terms of how do we ensure that we actually get throughput. That when the money goes, that there's actually, because that's not necessarily your responsibility. And therefore, I see fragmentation around the support. Just the point that you've made, acting CEO, around the management of institutions, dealing with financial support. Members will also remember that, in fact, in July of this year, we raised the potential of engaging at that level. In fact, in our visit to NSFAS, we said we want, by the end of October, November, I can remember, we summarized it. It was then both portfolio committees that went there. We said we actually want to see a meeting between NSFAS, rectors, and ourselves, because we were concerned about this matter. Seems to me there's a little bit of a better take-up, but I think what we're going to do, we're going to write to all the rectors and vice chancellors. We will write to all of them to raise this issue and ask them, for example, to have a closer watch over this process. We're concerned about 2 years from now, but we're equally concerned because the masses has raised this issue with us, with all the political parties pre the elections, and I think out of the election manifestos, we are also seeing the question around financial support coming through quite sharply. With that, members of NSFAS, thank you. Please pass our acknowledgement on to all the members and staff compliments. We've picked up that even in the annual report that we're not seeing this through all the details in terms of compliance relating to even the demographics, the vacancies, what type of vacancies there are, all of that. And we would want advice that actually that comes into reporting processes as well. But we know a lot of your people there when we visited, they are working in a difficult environment because it's really a house. And it's not the best space. So pass our gratitude onto them and everything of the best, Mr. Esop, for the remainder of the time. However, I do think as a responsible manager, just look at this transitional processes even and how do we make sure that some of those things are happening. But we will now not ask again the scarce skills question. We're going to help finding answers now because we feel that we didn't, up till now, we're not getting. We're just hearing the problem and we're hearing the issue, but we're not getting it. So we'll convene a meeting by next week with the minister, not necessarily the full committee, but representatives of the committee and yourself. Thanks a lot. Can we move over to... Yeah. The Council on Higher Education, and I suspect it's going to be 3 minutes. Do members want to have a comfort break? Sorry, yeah, I thought I should have asked earlier. Let me give General Magaza the comfort break quickly for 3 minutes. Okay, back in 5 minutes. To the Dr. Delaray to our meeting. I asked right in the beginning, should we, I actually asked him which one are we going to do first, and he said NSFAS, and I thought, should we not deal with your one first and actually get you to fly back if you flew in, but then I thought it's actually good for you just to appreciate some of the issues that comes from a sister body of yourself, and likewise in his fast, just to get a bit of reflection on the issues around Council for Higher Education at the portfolio committee level. But over to yourself.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and members of the Portfolio Committee, and thank you for the opportunity to present our annual report. We've prepared a presentation, which is quite short, and most of the slides will focus on the financial details, but if there's anything we omitted, we will, of course, answer the questions afterwards. The first slide is just to indicate that in the past financial year, or the year on which we're reporting, our mandate areas were advising the minister on the minister's request and at our own initiative, monitoring the state of the higher education system and the achievement of policy objectives. We have, of course, through our Higher Education Quality Committee, responsibility for quality assurance and quality promotion. And generally, we expected in our activities to contribute to the development of higher education. The last item on the slide before you is in fact only effective in the current financial year, not in the year on which we're reporting. In the year on which we're reporting, that is the 08-09 years, I would like to report overall it was a year of review and some degree of change within the Council on Higher Education. Firstly, we at our annual consultative conference invited feedback and comment on the way in which the Council conducts its advisory function. So in essence, it served as a review of the advisory function of the CAG. I shall also report later that in the reporting year, we had an independent review of the quality assurance and quality promotion work of the HEQC, and that in the same year, we, after discussions at our board or council level and also with the ministry, we were able to purchase a building, and in the current financial year, we've relocated. The main reason for the move of the council to new office premises was issues were raised in our previous audits that we did not have secure facilities for our IT resources and particularly our server. There was no fireproofing in the building. And secondly, we were not at that point compliant with the requirements of the Occupational Health and Safety Act. And we now believe we've met all the requirements in the new accommodation. So to start off with the advising the minister function, the way in which we conduct this activity is that we meet with the minister from time to time. There are ongoing discussions with the department. Those tend to be of the order of monthly discussions. We receive formal requests from the ministry for advice, and we also submit advice on our own initiative. And as I said, what we did in the 08-09 year was look at how we conduct this function, and some of the feedback we received, or at least the main feedback, was that the council was taking too long in delivering advice to the ministry and that we needed to change the timelines. And part of the reason for this was when we received a request, what we often do is commission research and then formulate the advice, and the research takes time. Or we conducted extensive consultations with stakeholders. But now we've introduced the capacity to collect information ourselves and use that information to provide advice within a shortened time frame. And we also convene expert-based groupings. So we use the expertise and also on that basis submit advice to the ministry, hopefully in a way that's much more effective for both the ministry and the department. In the reporting period, we provided advice on a draft policy on distance education. We also provided advice on an amended policy on funding for public higher education. And we provided advice on institutional autonomy and academic freedom based on the work that had been done in prior years. We also initiated work but have not completed the set of advice on the undergraduate curriculum and the question of whether the norm for the BSc, BA, and BCom should move from a three-year versus a four-year degree program. We have, in fact, submitted some comments on the issue of the impact of the higher education qualifications framework on universities of technology. We also started work on community engagement and have submitted some reports to the ministry on that matter. And we convened a grouping of vice chancellors to look into a strategy for rural-based higher education. All of that was within the broad advisory function of the CAG. Then with respect to our monitoring function, what we identified is that we need to collect information more systematically. And we are currently working on the development of a monitoring framework for higher education. We ourselves don't do primary research. We rely on data collected by other organizations. But in the State of Higher Education report that we've just completed last month, in doing that work, we've identified a number of gaps in the information on higher education institutions and the way the system is working. And by listening to the questions posed to the NSFUS team, more gaps were identified in the system. And so what we believe is necessary is a coherent monitoring framework within the subsequent identification of organizations responsible for keeping the information that we then can collate to do a more fulsome state of higher education reports. We, in fact, had some years ago started collecting information about the private higher education sector, and I'm very pleased to report that in this financial year we're seeing progress on that. But the work was done the initial work was done in the year that we're now reporting on, namely the 08-09 years. Part of the monitoring function also involves developing profiles of institutions, and these profiles are then put before the panels who conduct the quality assurance audits of institutions. In the 08-09 year, these profiles were done for UNISA, Nelson Mandela Metropolitan University, UKZN, and Northwest University, and all of those have now been audited. The publications we published in the 08-09 year, publication on service learning in the disciplines, the one on academic freedom and institutional autonomy, and another on postgraduate studies in South Africa. I'm now going to move to the quality assurance function. And here, Honourable Chair, I'd like to apologize on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Liz Langer, who is responsible for this work, but she's on sick leave. If there are any questions I can't handle, we'll submit the answers in writing after today. But in terms of quality assurance, one of the big work areas is program accreditation. In the 08-09 year, as we indicate in the annual report, 130 new higher education programs were submitted by both public and private providers of higher education. We do this through an extensive peer review process, and we have calculated that the success rate was 93% for the public higher education institutions and 58% for the private. In that same reporting year, we also started the process of reaccrediting 48 private providers' programs. Another part of the process comes under national reviews, and this is essentially a reaccreditation process within disciplinary areas, also by extensive peer review, and all programs that in the previous cycle had been subject to conditions were then followed up to ensure that the conditions had been met before accreditation was granted. And we've reported on the programs that were affected in the period of review as indicated on the slide, and there's more detail in the annual report. The one that gets covered most in the media is the institutional audits conducted by the ATQC. And during the 08-09 year, this in fact was the fifth year of implementing these institutional audits. We, by the end of 2011, expect to have audited all the public higher education institutions, but there has been a request from one to postpone the audit to 2012, and that request is currently under consideration. In the 08-09 year, five audits were conducted. Panels visited these universities, and from the previous round, in the previous reporting period, five audit reports were officially approved. And in relation to the future, we undertake audit readiness workshops with institutions prior to them being audited, and two of those were done in the reporting period. What happens following an audit report being finalized, institutions are then asked to respond by submitting improvement plans. These improvement plans are to indicate how they will deal with the recommendations or address the recommendations that come out of the institutional audit. We then have responsibility for analyzing the improvement plans and to make sure that they, in a satisfactory way, address the recommendations. And then, of course, there's a monitoring process that has to be followed through. Another part of the work of the ATQC is quality promotion and capacity development. And here what we've been focusing on in the reporting period is the question of student participation in the quality assurance processes that we undertake. A number of workshops and fora were arranged, but we're looking specifically at the implementation of a website and banners and conducting a number of what we might call outreach and training workshops with students. I would then like to point out that in terms of the Higher Education Act, Higher Education Quality Committee may delegate certain of its quality assurance functions to higher education institutions. And in the reporting period, the HEQC completed the framework for delegated functions, and there was delegated responsibility for 12 institutions, and these are mostly for short courses. I will now invite my colleague, Dr. Jan Beerkes, to report on the finance and human resources aspects of our work in the 08-09 year. Sorry, Chair, we look a bit odd because we can't see the presentation on our screen. We're reading from the top.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the Portfolio Committee. I will briefly deal, as my colleague has said, with the finance and the HR, and then I will conclude with a brief overview of our performance indicators. If I may start with our balance sheet, there's only one thing that I would like to highlight, actually two things. The one is that in the prior year, we had an accumulated surplus of about 24.4 million, and towards the end of the prior year, we had converted that into a fixed asset, which is the building that Dr. Delaray referred to. And then, if you see at the current assets, at the end of the financial year, we were left with cash in the bank of just less than $500,000, 486,000 rand. So we have no longer any accumulated reserves. We nevertheless, like our colleagues from NSFAS, also applied to retain that little surplus that we had. And then just two things that I would like to highlight. The one is in terms of the trade and other payables, the 1.8. It's a liability, Chair. In our operational policies, we provide that private providers, when they submit applications for accreditation, we recover some of the cost. And we expect them to make a payment up front. And we then start processing the documents. Now, this is an accounting principle, so that it's still a liability. Although they've paid, we must still deliver the service, and this is why the 1.8, and it's slightly less than the previous year, and the reason for that being a lot of those programs that were submitted did not comply in the beginning and had to be referred back, so the processing was a little bit longer. And yeah, I think this is as far as that one is concerned. So this is a summary of our income statement, and I just want to highlight two things there. The one is the investment revenue. In the previous year, we were able to earn 2.8 million through our accumulated reserves. Now that we don't have that kind of reserves, our income from that source will be significantly less in the next financial year, which is obviously a concern to us. In the past, we managed to redeploy some of that funding for some urgent projects that we were able to conduct, and that is now could be a little bit of a constraint. Then the second one, the surplus of the year is 3.7. Now, this is an accounting surplus, Chair. It is not a cash surplus, and I will now briefly deal with that. The 3.7, and then the operating surplus, in that 3.7, there's a number of items that are not cash. They are what we call the non-cash items, such as depreciation and loss on sale of assets, impairment loss, movement in operating lease liability, and so forth. So if we take the surplus before taxation, as we put it there, and we subtract those issues, and then we get an operating profit of 1.6, we add the interest and we subtract the building, you will see right at the bottom there, this is the surplus that we have in the bank, the cash, the 486,239. This is the revenue. We are almost 100% dependent on the government grant, and that was that was 31.2 million, and that grows with the MTEF between 5.3 and 5.4% annually. The donations received, that was from two donor funding projects, and we were given the opportunity to retain the surplus of those funds. And then the private accreditation, as I've mentioned, it's about 9 million. 900,000. Then, Chair, during the year under review, the CHG obviously was under huge pressure. As my colleague indicated, although the standard setting function was new to the CHG, we adopted that function without any funding, additional funding. So we had to start working on that, albeit on a small scale, by redeploying some of our funding. And last, in June this year, there was a suggestion or there was a request from this committee that we should look at opportunities to save some money on consultants. And I think we did manage to do that quite effectively. As you can see, on the admin side, there was a 70% saving. On the consultants, there was a 14% saving. And the consultant item used to be one of the big expense items on our annual expense report. So there was quite a significant saving. And then the travel and subsistence and the venue and catering, and I think I should just highlight that travel and subsistence and venue and catering is the way that we conduct our business. A lot of our business takes place off-site at the campuses of institutions, at workshops and so forth. And this is why that is a significant expenditure, and we would like the portfolio committee to see that really try to. And then with the new building, Chair, we have managed to save a lot of expenses in that regard. So workshops that otherwise would have been conducted in other venues, we are now able to entertain in our own building. Briefly on our profiles.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Could you just explain what that 2% other expenses, that 5 million and other expenses, what is that?
Well, collectively, I'll have to go back to the detailed statement. I'm not able to tell you exactly what they are now. I can try and briefly refer you to the detailed income statement on page 83 of our annual report. You would see the IT expenses, these insurance, rentals and operating lease, legal expenses, media and communications expenses, and a number of those issues. Each of them a small amount in its own. This is why we just collated them and report on them collectively.
Advertising.
Yeah, no, that's advertising. It's extremely expensive, Jim. Now, this is the race profile. Now, roughly 60% of our staff are black, and this is what we try to project there. And with the gender profile, like all other, like the teaching profession, and I think the civil service, about 60% of our employees are female. So this is more or less the norm. And then finally, on the vacancy profile, Chair, this is a bit of a concern. We operated for most of the year with a vacancy ratio of about between 20 and 25%. And even the business plan that we submitted provided for not filling those positions, as I indicated to you that given the fact that the new mandate area was not funded. We had some good news yesterday with the budget that another 9 million would be transferred to the CHG, and part of that will certainly be used to give effect to the mandate area and to supplement some of the other functions. Then in terms of our performance areas, if you look at the annual report, I think we have about 30 areas that we've identified that we report on in terms of performance, and I just highlight a number of them. Advising the minister, there were 4 instances, new programs assessed, 130 programs reaccredited, 259 and so forth, 5 audits, and the new publications too. And I'm not sure how many of the members are aware of the new publication, The Status of Higher Education, giving you the most recent overview of at least what the statistical overview is in terms of higher education. And members who have not received that, we would be happy to put them on our mailing list so that they can get that on a regular basis. Chair, in a nutshell, this is what I have to report on in terms of our HR finances and performance indicators. I'd like to hand over to my colleague again.
Just two comments. The report that Dr. Bierk has referred to is on its way to the Portfolio Committee by bulk mail, so you will receive it, but it's also on our website. And then just to go back to the consultants item, Chairperson, many of those are not, they're the peer reviewers, and when it comes to financial statements, they're reflected in as consultants. To conclude, Chairperson, we once again have an unqualified audit report. There were no issues raised in our management letter. One of the issues our audit committee has asked us to take up is the cost of the audit, and we have in fact begun discussion with the AG's office about the cost of the audit, given that we're not a large organization, and we do anticipate that the discussions we've started would lead to a more an amount being charged that's more equivalent to the size of our budget. With respect to the work of the council and all its committees, they've complied with all the principles of good governance that they are meant to, and this is reflected in the management letter and in the annual report. And this is now in the current financial year. The 21st of October, Chairperson, when you had in fact invited us, was our annual consultative conference. And what we do in that conference is raise a key national issue for debate. And this year we focused on the role of universities in a post-school high education and training system. It was a very productive discussion. We later this week will in fact send the report of the proceedings to the ministry and to the department, and we think they will find it useful with respect to the strategy going forward. And I would like to thank the Portfolio Committee for your support, and particularly for helping us resolve the matter of how we fund our new mandate area. So thank you very much for that. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks a lot. I thought it would be in order for the members just to give them a hand, because I think it was a very good. It's not always that we are, I mean, like if I reflect on page 27, Doctor, that on the report of the Auditor General on those financial compliance matters and systems matters, that one can actually see adherence to all of them. I still want to register the point that, and it's a bigger issue around, and in the previous discussion with NSFAS, we also made the point that I've seen many departments complying, but if you actually look at the effect on societal change, you don't necessarily see those things coming through. And if there's a deeper reflection, in a sense, take something else, take differently. If you start looking at infrastructure portfolios, the moment that you talk about women empowerment, youth empowerment, and all of that, suddenly it becomes more difficult to comply, because you're now actually dealing with the real transformational issues in society. And so that's the reality. That's the irony when we say yes, yes, yes for financial compliance, which then becomes a minimum parameter, but not necessarily, for example, the quality of what we want to see in our society. We'll obviously want to zoom at the next round into that type of aspects. What is the benefit on our society as you're proceeding? Are you rehashing all the old experts? And in what way is there even like a opportunity for your younger experts to grow through your research? You know, it's that issue in your environment. But I think we've seen the annual report. We've seen the AD's comments. It isn't good at your organization. There's a few documents that I think it would be important and needed to get ASAP. the distance education policy that was submitted to the minister some time ago, the institutional autonomy and academic freedom, one, the rural-based higher education, and I think the one that you just referred to, the status of higher education. I think on page 39 in this document, but you've addressed it, the question of the new mandate and then the difficulty of funding processes around that, I think it was mentioned at some stage in our committee as well. I get a sense that in this latter response that at least you are now saying that that's being managed currently. We know you can always do with more money, but at least there is now some funding for that. And then our committee in a different, with SACPA, we did raise the concern around private providers and the accreditation or lack of accreditation at times and people walking around the certificates that's not necessarily accredited. So that's some of the issues that over the last month or so we've also highlighted. But if you can get to another those documents that, because it speaks to even the strategic objectives, the 6 strategic objectives on HR that were identified is very important, but it's not being, it doesn't come through in the document. So the point has been registered, but one can't actually analyze what is those things in this document. Members, any other comments and questions in this regard? Dr. James?
I just had a question and then a comment. It's really to urge you to consider taking on a new project, which is to evaluate the quality of residences that we have at universities and colleges, and quality both in terms of the physical infrastructure, but also the social architecture, how it's arranged in terms of the learning and teaching model at a university. We know just anecdotally, I mean, I visited Swanee University of Technology on our way back from our visit to Limpopo. And I went to a residence on Garankuwa campus, which is just outside of Roslyn. I mean, I was amazed at how well it was run and how well it was organized and the quality of the students and so on. But we know that there are good residences and there are actually slums at some universities. So I think an assessment of the quality would be very welcome. So I'm just urging that. I'm just raising it as an issue. My question is about the quality of your interaction with the minister. And I don't mean I'm not asking you to speak out of turn, but simply to ask you whether you are happy with the mandate element which says that you are advising the minister. How does it work? He asks for advice. You suggest advice. I mean, what is the nature of that interaction? So I was just curious about that.
Thank you, Chairperson. Rural areas are highly populated with young people. Now, my question here is, have you tried to conduct a survey in rural areas in order to be in a position to advise the minister as to how many FET colleges or universities are actually needed in those areas? Because most of the young people move out of the rural areas, go into urban areas to try and access institutions of higher learning when they could be having them there. Secondly, I see you spending quite a lot of money on consulting fees. Is it necessary that you have to have consultants? When you have internal staff that perhaps could be qualified to do the job that is done by consultants. Thank you.
Chairperson, I'm looking at page 18 of the report where there are programs from the institutions, and I'm a little bit worried about the conditional accreditation that we are giving to most of the programs from the universities, as to say, can you expand more on those conditions? What is it?
Why can't they be given full accreditation? Because I believe while they have given that conditional accreditation, but it's continuing being offered to the students, and doesn't it affect the students, the output, the quality of the qualification at the end? Because really, most of the institutions there, they get these conditionally. They are very few with the full accreditation of the whole program, if you can explain that to me.
Chairperson, I'm just going to pick up on the issue of publicizing of accredited institutions. Sometimes we find that kids are enrolled at fly-by-nights or institutions that aren't, and only then to the parents are when these children need to graduate. So, and I have seen it in the newspapers at one stage, the accredited institutions, but what is the institution doing to really get this publicized? Thank you.
Chairperson, if I may start with the...
Yes. Okay, it's just to let one have some understanding in terms of the provision of the Act when appointing council members. There's members who are elected, I think it's on page 36 or so. I wanted to check it, but there are members who are appointed and non-voting, and according to that act, oh yes, it's on page 29. Yes, it's on 29. Yes, I'm just checking as to whether, for instance, representatives of the DST, DOE, SAQA, and so on, are they getting there as ex-officio or as non-voting persons appointed on their own or in their own rights, or necessarily because they represent those particular institutions? I just wanted to check the provision of the Act in that particular regard.
To start with the most recent question with respect to page 29, the Act specifies that they are appointed by the Minister in the ex-official capacities, and they attend all meetings, but should it come down to a vote on any matter, they don't have the right to exercise a vote. And it tends to work quite well in the sense that it ensures a fair degree of coordination in our work with the areas of responsibility of those bodies represented on the council in the ex-officio capacities. There was another question about the publicizing of accredited institutions. Chair, if I may just make an observation, by all accounts, the regulatory system we have in place in South Africa is a very good system. The question I think the department and government has struggled with is some people blatantly ignore the system. What punitive measures could be taken against them? We don't accredit the institutions themselves. The department does that. What we do is accredit the program. But to answer the question on publicizing which of those are accredited, we're working in partnership with SAQA and Uma Lucy and the Quality Council for Trades and Occupations on the NQF advocacy campaign, which has been discussed for the past year or more. And the idea of that campaign is exactly to do that, to make the public aware, and particularly potential students and their sponsors aware of that there should be accreditation, that it should be advertised, and what does accreditation mean? So that's our contribution to that question. There's a question about conditional accreditation. Where in the report you will see reference to teach out plans. In many cases, the reaccreditation points to an outcome in the sense that this program should not be continued. But there are always students in stream or in those programs. So the institutions then must pay attention to improving the quality for those students, but they won't be able to continue the program, mostly because they don't have the human infrastructure or the right level of quality, staff qualifications and physical infrastructure in many cases to continue. The reasons for conditional vary per institution and per program, and should members wish to have specific information, I'll have to get it. I don't have it with me. But we have a framework of criteria against which we accredit, and where there are concerns, conditional accreditation is granted subject to the institution demonstrating that they have addressed those areas that they should address, and in many cases this requires a site visit by our expert panel members. And that relates to the question about consultant fees. We have in fact reduced the number of research or those types of projects for which we use consultants by developing our advice and monitoring directorate. We've appointed staff there, including creating two posts for researchers. The consultant fees, however, will remain because the quality assurance relies on these expert peers, and in terms of our financial reports, they get recorded as consultants. They what in the higher education system is known as honoraria that we pay, but because we use so many, for each program being accredited to their peers, that's how it accumulates. They're actually small sums per peer reviewer, but when you add them up, it comes to quite a lot. Also, for the institutional audits, it's an entire panel, and they're recorded as consultants in the financial statements. So when we manage this internally, we distinguish between those who are peer reviewers versus those who you might call consultants in how it's commonly understood, and we've cut down, that's how we've cut down on the use of consultants, by doing more in-house work. On the rural areas, we have not conducted a survey on how many FET colleges are needed in those areas. To date, we haven't done work on the FET college sector because it hasn't been in our mandate. Where we've wanted to make a contribution, we then work with organizations who are responsible for those areas. But this is a question that will now face, or at least the CHE has been discussing. What are the implications for post-school higher education and training framework for our mandate? It's something to be considered, and the council has been debating this. So we are mindful of that. The project that we started on provision in rural areas for the moment is restricted to the universities in rural areas. And that has taken off. The five vice chancellors have now agreed to convene on their own to discuss a strategy. And in fact, we were working with the NRF looking at a number of specific projects for which the universities are funded to assist in developing the research contribution and the capacity building contribution of those five institutions. So as a CHE, we're quite willing to do additional work, but to date it hasn't been clearly within our mandate with respect to the FET sector. On the quality of the interaction with the minister, between June of this year to date, I've met with the minister four times. And so we've met frequently, and I've been highly satisfied because the minister puts questions to us. And based on the information we have or we do not have, we then provide answers or indicate that we will provide advice in the future on the matter, but we still have some work to do. So that's essentially how it works. In providing the advice, we consult with the sector where appropriate. So recently, one of the questions we're currently working on is the use of the term university for private institutions. So we're about to finalize that advice and send that to the minister. We've looked at a number of other countries as case studies to inform the advice we delivered to the minister, and that came out of a direct question that the ministry posed to us. But again, from the State of Higher Education report that we do and the information we gather, we then identify issues and indicate to the minister that this is something that needs to be looked at, and on that basis we submit the advice. On the proposed new project on the quality of the residences, that's something we can definitely take up. I think for the future, though, it might be something we'll certainly think about how to do this, how to develop an indicator so that we could report regularly in the State of Higher Education report and answer the question, what is the quality of provision in the residences, both in terms of its physical infrastructure and social architecture. To date, we have some information, but the information would be based only from those institutions where we've conducted institutional audits. We wouldn't have information on the whole system. Thank you, Chairperson.
Members, Member Makabela.
So your pardon is just still the same thing. I want to develop that. If I just want to understand something. This clause here says you have the chairperson in terms of council members, and you can as well nominate or appoint 13 ordinary members. There's allowance that you can have less than that. And if there is less, people will be told what could have led to that, you know. That will be 14. You've got co-opted members. Yes, it's not clear how many you could go for co-opted members, as much as you want or what. But there are three members co-opted, and this one. That takes you to 17. You've got those who are ex-officials. In this particular case, there are four. You know, and that takes you to 21. And just here, when you look at this, we can as well have 23 or even more. But all I wanted to understand is I know also in terms of the amended act, the minister can as well have 8 members, but currently in terms of the year under review, you could have 6 non-voting. Whether in this particular case, because if you were to add that 6, it takes the number a bit even higher. I just wanted to understand the number that we have got currently vis-a-vis the provision of the Act and why we couldn't have had the full complement, if there's anything in that.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, in this 08-09 year, there were vacancies on the council. Some members' terms had expired and they were not available, or they had already served 2 terms. There was also 2 resignations, but by now all of those vacancies have been filled. So in the next report that serves before this committee, there will be a full complement. On the question of the limit to co-option, there is no limit in the Act. I think in general governance principles, though, the council is mindful of keeping the number of co-options at a low level because obviously the principle is that the voting members should always have a clear majority and not a slim majority. But the Act itself doesn't put an upper limit on co-option.
So clearly, it's open-ended, but there's governance principles that where board sits and say, but this is really what you can actually afford or what's relevant. Members, we came to the end of this presentation. It seems to me you are also involved at this conclusionary remarks with a draft policy framework for the new department. Not necessarily.
Yeah, I was invited to one of the strategy sessions, and the questions raised there were questions we discussed in our consultative conference. So the report we're submitting to the department should have active input into the...
Okay, that process. Okay, because I think sometime in November we're supposed to see the light on a draft statement from the minister on his policy objectives. That is what was committed to us. Doctor, let me then thank you, and also again, please pass on our regards to your whole institute. And let's keep a good cooperative engagement going. I'm interested, obviously, and we'll get it from the minister, on some of the discussions that took place last week, your post-schooling, because that is obviously relevant to the debate, and the upskilling opportunities even into higher education levels from post-schooling level. With that, thank you, and Professor Flubeck.
I just wanted to say that Dr. Dollaray is assuming the position of Vice-Chancellor at Rexit University of Pretoria in November, and I'm sure my colleagues would agree with me to say good luck.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Doctor. Can we then excuse both NSFAS as well as Council for Higher Education, and then we'll continue with our meeting, hopefully for the next 10 minutes. Members, what we are supposed to deal with now is the minutes of the 2nd of September, the 6th of the 9th of September, sorry, and then the 16th of September. That's what we need to deal with. Can I present the minutes, therefore, the draft minutes of the 6th of September? You would recall it related to an internal meeting. We didn't have NSFAS there, if I can recall. It was just out of the discussions that we had over more than a month, we've reflected on some of the recommendations.
Chairman, I went through the minutes quite carefully of all three meetings, and I have quite a few comments. Some of the comments, I think I'm just going to hand it over to Anneli,
okay.
So that he can see it. So, but in terms of the substance, I have no problem.
Okay. Substance is fine. Yeah, there was here and there, for example, grammar, editing, and those things. I've also picked that up. If we can park the just peripheral corrections like spelling, that we can submit to Anneli. Anything else of substantial nature? Can we then put forward the minutes of the 2nd of September for approval? Yes. Silence is supporting that. Am I right? Thanks. Zoraina, you're not supposed to put your hand up, so we're not going to. Okay. The 9th of September, can we accept this? Right. Ms. Dudley, that's now and then in our committee. I'm just kidding. The way you have to deal with oral, teasing you. Page 3. Whether? Oh, page 3, the 4th paragraph there.
Okay. I picked up on a lot of those sorts of grammatical things, so I'll just give it to
Okay. Then we
Ms. Mshwana?
Yes,
great. Makubele, you are supporting in the absence of Laketro. Then the last one, dated the 16th of September. Again, there would be grammatical issues there, for example, unemployed youth and youth, there's here and there, some of those, if we can just correct that, but I also think this is fine, the substance. Dennis, are you supporting this? Khadebe? And we've got, okay, cool. Then we've adopted the minutes, and that would end our business. Just to indicate, let me just indicate, yeah. Why don't you speak to the members? So tell us.
I was just informing the chairperson that next week we will be having our joint meeting with Basic Education, whereby we'll be doing the annual report of the Department of Education. So we'll start on Tuesday and Wednesday, so it'll be 2 days.
Also, members, I've asked, I think, Anela, most probably you got the request that that we need just to also give to all the members a copy of the Department of Labor annual discussions on the annual reports dealing with CETAs. I just think if members can, just to go and sit in, because it's actually the handover. And if you are then there, those that can, we'll try and even find a schedule for it. Then we do not, I mean, like the annual report becomes a good analysis in a sense of handover. So I'm just requesting members to look at the schedule and see where you can slot in. That's by arrangement between myself and the chairperson of the Labour Committee, Dr. James. It's there's a few, because remember there's 23 seats and the NSF, so it's over the spread over 2-3 weeks in the month of November. So what I've requested, Anela, is to circulate the schedule to you, and I don't think you can really go to everyone because it's quite a lot of meetings, but at least identify 2 or 3 of those that you. And then communicate that back to Anela, because then you become part of our deployment in there, not just you're sitting in as an ordinary observer in there. Dr. James?
I just wanted to request again a time slot where I wanted to share with members. Initially, I wanted to talk about the 4-year undergraduate degree, but that's not really the issue, because the 4-year undergraduate degree is part of the answer to improving graduation rates. So the problem is graduation rates, what's otherwise known inelegantly as throughput. I put it to the House yesterday as a matter for the House debate, and I would just like to ask for an hour of this committee's time where I can share with you what the proposal would be for finding solutions to that problem, part of which would be a 4-year degree.
Did get that initially, that request, after you wrote that personal letter against me. I thought I'm never going to allow you to do that. but I've decided just now to change that opinion. So what we'll do, I think let's do that. Because even in the social transformation and cohesion document from Minister Pando that moved into Minister Nzimande earlier this year, presented, you recall one of the recommendations for consideration was in fact that. So it does speak to a broader intervention, and especially if you look at 44% dropout, then there is a potential where you in fact can strengthen the catchment base in terms of graduation. So I think it would be an important discussion, and even in the House. So why don't we agree then that We schedule it properly. Seems to me not for next week, but then immediately for that week thereafter. So that will be then a critical discussion. And if we can ask Anela to circulate. In fact, you've got the social cohesion document. Let's look at the related documents. There's a publication here that Council for Higher Education indicated around the 4-year undergraduate. So let's also circulate that particular document to all our members, Anela,
over the next week, so that when we discuss, we're discussing it from an informed opinion. With that, thanks, members. Let's get back to other responsibilities. And thank you, Tiki, for being honoring us and not the communications portfolio today.